Coming up on Hear Me Out, is that really a stoplight on an interstate? And can traffic from Wisconsin merge with cars from Duluth without causing an accident?
If you're coming down Mesabi and you're going to go to Wisconsin, you'd have to weave all the way across to get into the left.
Right.
You got to
go
all the way across traffic.
Right.
And then this bad merge, you're going to go southbound 35 up to northbound 53. You can't see the people back behind you there coming from Wisconsin.
We'll look at repairs coming to the notorious Can of Worms intersection and the history behind how it got that way. Plus, are you ready for Mother's Day?
I don't believe in Mother's Day. I think it's a cheap way to sell greeting cards.
These stories and this week's regional news roundup after this. Welcome to Hear Me Out. I'm Robin Washington. If you're a regular driver around the Twin Ports, you've gotten to know the Can of Worms, maybe better than you want to know it. That's the three-way intersection a mile west of downtown Duluth, of Interstate 35, Minnesota Route 53 to the Iron Range, and Interstate 535 to Wisconsin. The nickname refers to the exit ramps going every which way.
You're just like cross-town traffic, so hard to get through to you.
Slogans for infamous traffic snarls aren't indigenous to the Twin Ports. Chicago has the spaghetti bowl, there's the mousetrap in Denver, and even another Can of Worms in Rochester, New York. But our Can of Worms has some unique attributes.
If you're coming down Mesabi and you're going to go to Wisconsin, you'd have to weave all the way across to get into the left.
Right,
you got to go all the way across traffic. Left exits aren't normal. Now it's going to be a right exit, more traditional. And then this bad merge, you're going to go southbound 35 up to northbound 53. You can't see the people back behind you there coming from Wisconsin. It's really bad.
That's John Kershak, a design manager for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. He joined Twin Ports Interchange Project Manager Roberta Dwyer and other MnDOT staffers in a series of public forums about the interchange and the four-year, $342 million plan to replace it. And what may also be unique for a hearing about a project costing hundreds of millions of dollars and promising to disrupt traffic on a main roadway for 4 years is that there's virtually no opposition. Megan Callahan and Brian Hawkinson use the expressway daily and live just down from where the work will take place.
We live off of 27th, so, I mean, it affects our traffic and everything. But on the other hand, all this highway's a mess, and it's good to have it rebuilt. Like,
we come home right along this stretch here in this blind merge here. Where if it comes down and merges with it merges with traffic coming from Superior, and this is a very blind merge, and we almost every day,
I would say we see. Once a week we drive past and we see a car accident there.
Right.
So somebody, we were debating this online, and somebody said, "Well, one accident a week's not bad." I'm like, "Well, no, I'm
driving
by.
One that you
it's
see.
30 right. seconds per day, so the period of like one accident per 4 minute span every week."
That doesn't count the close calls that we see there, too, which are
a lot more frequent. It's getting rid of two awful intersections there, so.
So it'll be an inconvenience, but I think it's worth
greater
it to
good.
Have that.
The main reason for such widespread acceptance of the replacement is safety. The accident count at the interchange is among the highest in Minnesota. Those include fatalities, for which we can only mourn and hope safety and safe driving habits improve. Yet to understand how things got this way, it's worth taking a look at history.
With the passage by Congress of the Federal Aid Highway Act of 1956, the national system of interstate and defense highways got underway. Under this system, it is intended to build 41,000 miles of multiple-lane, controlled access highways in 15 years. Highways of the future.
Interstate 35 runs the depth of the United States, from Texas to Duluth. Construction on the interchange took place from 1967 to 69, initially only connecting I-35 to I-535 to Wisconsin. But after construction, Mindus John Kershak says,
politics is what I've learned. This and that were the only things supposed to be designed.
35 and 535.
This was supposed to use old Piedmont and Garfield.
53.
Yep.
Right.
And politics came in and said, you will build this.
Twin Ports Interchange project manager Roberta Dwyer adds the details.
As part of the original plan for what's known as the can of worms, the movement from northbound 35 to northbound 53 was not included as part of the original plan. It was anticipated that people who wanted to take that route would exit at 27th Avenue West, go over to Superior Street or First Street, and then go over to the ramps at 21st Avenue West. However, during the construction, after that was found out by the local business community, they and the Duluth City Council went to the state legislature and ordered MnDOT to put in that ramp.
Although retrofitting a connection to Route 53 was nearly an engineering impossibility, Dwyer says there were several innovations that made it possible.
It was very difficult to do that because of the grades. You can only have a maximum amount of grade on a ramp, and trying to bring that ramp up and over and then still have it touch down somewhere on 53 in the Lincoln Park area would have required a huge structure over everything else, plus the acquisition of a lot of the right-of-way and buildings in Lincoln Park. So someone, and we don't know who, came up with the idea to put a signal on the ramp. And it was actually, at the time, a very ingenious idea, and it did save a lot of money and accomplish what needed to be done there.
One of those who worked on it is Jerry Quala, a surveyor on a construction site who retired from MnDOT in the early 2000s. And until someone disputes it, he's likely the first one to dub the spot the can of worms. I spoke with him from his home in Mountain Iron, Minnesota. I'm honored if I'm really talking to the guy who coined the term can of worms. Is that true?
Well, I was the first one to use the term as far as I know. Whether somebody else did too, it should have credit. But I know I used the term when I first saw the plan for the interchange down there, and as far as I know, I'm the one that coined it.
So back me up. Your job was at the time?
My job at the time was survey crew chief for all the connecting road, all the on-ground stuff. The bridges had a different survey team, but I had all the on-ground stuff, so I had to make sure the roads hit the bridges.
What did you think of all the merges and the mere idea of a traffic light on an interstate, which I believe was a rarity?
Well, I can't speak to that. That was, at that time, that would have been above my pay grade. At that time, was coined as the only set of signals on the entire length of I-35 from Texas to Minnesota.
That would be a rarity.
Yeah.
There's a book that I've become quite familiar with reporting on transportation called The Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices. Do you think it encourages traffic lights on interstates?
No. I would have expected that it required special federal government permission to have this situation.
Is there any other way to do it? And I understand, again, you're the guy implementing the plan, not designing it.
Well, yes. I have not thought about that for several reasons. One, it was a big enough job just to, do all the staking for the on-ground roadways. Mm-hmm. And two, I left Duluth in the 70s and was transferred to Virginia, so I didn't have a lot of occasion to drive, although I've been through it, quite a few times since. But it wasn't a daily thought of mine, if you get what I'm trying to say.
Right. Like the people who do drive it every day and think about it.
Yeah.
When you said can of worms, were you thinking in terms of the construction, executing the plans, or the people using it every day trying to drive it?
We have in the plans what's called a plan view. Some people might call it an airplane view. I was a fisherman as a boy, and I used angle worms, and I carried them in a tin can. And so they got all tangled up in there, And if you looked down into the can, you would see them going every which way, and that's where the term came from for me.
In other words, the plans were quite familiar to you from your fishing experience.
Yeah, you could say that, yeah. So when I looked at the plan view, it had roadways all tangled up going every which way, and it just struck me that it looked like a can of worms that I was familiar from my boyhood days.
Right. What had you worked on beforehand?
Well, I started at Minnesota Highway Department, it was called back then, on June 10th, 1964. And that first summer, not my first job, but early on in that first summer, I was, if I'm remembering the dates correctly, I was assigned to, well, it was a big contract to dredge out of the harbor sand and build the 535 roadway by pumping dredged sand into that area. So I worked on that. It was a 24/7 project. I worked 13 out of 14 days every 2 weeks from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. So that was my first connection. The next year, in 1965, I was assigned as an inspector at 27th Avenue West, where we were starting to build the bridges over the freeway to come and building frontage roads that now go down to the Duluth sewage plant. And then in 1967, I was, MnDOT needed surveyors, so they sent me to school for 6 weeks, and I came back and became a surveyor on the interchange.
That's where you were when these plans showed up.
Yeah. The scenario I recall, I would have been handed a set of plans and said, well, go ahead and start staking it.
I understand also that you're a car collector.
I am.
What do you have in your collection?
Well, my oldest is a 1937 Ford. Next oldest is a 1951 Ford, which is the very first car I ever had. Same thing as the very first car I ever had. And I got a 55 Ford pickup, and I had a 64 Ford Galaxy, and an 86 T-Bird.
Are they drivable?
No. Well, I just bought the 51 in Wisconsin, southern Wisconsin, last fall, and it came out of storage where it had been for 40 years. And so the brakes aren't any good, so it needs some work, and I'm searching for somebody to do that for me. But the other four were drivable when they were parked. So
the 51 you got from Wisconsin, did you drive it home?
No, I trailered it.
Okay, but you would have had to go over the can of worms, I think, right?
Yes, I would have.
Were you worried about that?
No. I've been over it a few times. I have a 40-foot motorhome, and I've been over it a few times too with that. So I guess. I guess things like that don't scare me.
I've got a collector car of my own, a 1997 Mazda Miata. And I have to say, in trying to make some of the merges where you can't quite see this Miata behind a barrier, I've done some cursing of the can of worms and may have cursed your work in the process.
Well, you have to realize that highway design standards have greatly evolved over the years. I mean, we used to build massive interchanges, and a lot of that has changed over the years as people thought of better ways of doing things.
Right. Has anyone ever praised it?
Well, I can't. I think the cursing part of it is relatively recent, as far as my experience has been. I retired in 2003, and I don't recall any public outcry over the design up to that point. So maybe whatever spurred somebody to look at it and want to change it, and that becoming public solicited some negative comments from people. But no, we didn't live in an environment of, boy, we sure screwed up when we did that in my working days.
Well, you didn't have social media back then.
Right? Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and I think more so today everybody's an expert.
Conversely, were you proud of the work?
I would say yes. I think of I made a couple of mistakes when in my survey work. One I never could figure out, but it's held up many years. So
what was that?
Why I couldn't get some grades to fit right. they didn't, the concrete was the right thickness, but the gravel underneath, I could never figure out why it wasn't the right thickness. So that's only an insider that would know that. And generally speaking, these things are over-designed, so it didn't cause any problems down the road.
Literally speaking, down the road.
Yeah, I was just going to say in terms of failing pavements or things like that.
Right. Of course, I-35, on a very sober note, we know what could happen and did happen in the bridge collapse.
Yes.
Well, one thing I understand in the redesign is that a lot of it now will be at grade. So whatever problem you were encountering on the bridge, it won't have that rise after all.
Well, the bridges were, I think they were probably one of the first uses of what's called triangulation. There were calculations done, and there were some towers set up. And so from those towers, lines were projected, and where they intersected, that would be a particular point on the bridge from which to, you know, lay out the design. And that was probably, like I say, one of the first times that had been used in the state.
Any other thoughts about it?
Well, this is just a side note, but in 1961, the Botnick Bridge was opened, and I saw it in the news. I was a junior in high school with that 51 Ford of mine, and two of my lady friends and I came down and drove over the high bridge on that day it opened. Little did I know that I would be there just a few short years down the road working on the rest of the system.
Well, they got the right guy. He had experience from day one.
Yep.
Well, we've been speaking with Jerry Kuala, and thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was Jerry Kuala, a surveyor who helped build the I-35 interchange in 1967, and, unless someone comes forward to dispute it, first gave it his nickname as the Can of Worms. Okay, so now that we know the history and some of the stats, what's it like to drive the Can of Worms several times a day? Someone who knows is Bob Wilchers of Courtesy Cab in Superior. So tell me about the Can of Worms.
Well, there's really only two parts of the Can of Worms that are a problem. Number one is actually on a highway system, a freeway, for where we live, we would call it a freeway system. To have an actual four-way stop is kind of crazy. That part of the design. As a matter of fact, there was just an accident there where a semi had rear-ended some cars that were stopped.
Right.
You don't normally have a stop at the bottom of a hill on a freeway. You know, there's no shoulder for someone to try to get out of the way. So that's really an anomaly. And then there's also, if you're headed to Superior from West Duluth, there's the one section where two lanes merge together, but there's no yield, so there's no way to designate who's supposed to watch out for the other one.
Right.
Those two things definitely make it unique and are two things that hopefully would be corrected when it's redone.
And indeed, I saw the plans. And now they still do have a stop light, but not technically on the interstate. So
okay.
The distinction of it being the only interstate, only part of I-35 from here to Mexico that has a stoplight won't be true anymore.
You know, 99% of the time, there's just pretty good cooperation with drivers, you know, in the parts where you're merging, but there's no designation on who watches out for who. But it's the 1% or less. But it's the times where people aren't paying attention. You know, drivers tend to pay less attention nowadays. So you have something like that.
You're kidding. Are you talking about those little phones in our hands?
You know, and let me tell you something. From I drive 60 hours a week. I have been for 9 years. And there is no age, gender, anything specific to people staring at their phones. It's anywhere from just got their license to started driving a Model A, male, female, everybody. Not everyone does it, but every age, gender, et cetera, can be found guilty of staring at their telephone.
And I've taken it you've seen it at the intersection in question.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I've seen people going down the freeway in that intersection in the middle of a video chat with someone where they feel it necessary to hold the phone up so they can see the person they're talking to.
Well, there's a witness to what happens next.
Yeah.
Any specific memorable events?
It's worse in the wintertime. You add the combination of drivers paying less attention, maybe roads not being plowed as good or as quickly as they used to be, not using much salt or sand. It's definitely gotten worse instead of better.
Mm-hmm. You have a choice if you pick up somebody oh, Belknap and Hammond, how about that? And yep. They want to go to, oh, Lincoln Park Middle School. Which bridge do you take?
Would use the Blotnick Bridge.
You would use the Blotnick? Okay.
Yep, would use the Blotnick Bridge. Anything up until around 27th Avenue West from that area would use the Blotnick Bridge. Bong Bridge would be anything west end, maybe over around 40th. You find yourself backtracking quite a bit to take the Bong to then go to like 27th or 21st Avenue West.
Okay. So in that case, all things being equal, you'll still go through the can of worms.
Certainly. Yeah. Just pay a little extra attention. But yeah, it's a necessary evil, I guess.
All right. Well, again, I'm talking to Bob Riggers, okay?
Yep.
Of Courtesy Cab in Superior. He's not afraid of the can of worms.
No.
All right. Thanks so much.
Yep. Thank you.
So what are those $342 million improvements? The left exit ramps will be relocated to the right. Ramps will also be double lane longer to eliminate the abrupt merges. And the traffic signal will be reconfigured into a more of a standard T intersection than the current curve. Also, visibility of lanes will be enhanced.
However, the solution to all the problems lies most of all in public understanding. For only when each citizen becomes better informed about his state's highway program, only when he helps develop the popular support so essential to highway progress, can the nation meet the highway challenge. So the better, safer roads of tomorrow will become the roads of today.
This is Hear Me Out.
Welcome back to Hear Me Out. I'm Robin Washington. This Sunday is Mother's Day, and though it's meant to honor moms, it sometimes comes with its own anxieties. Among them, remembering to do simple things like getting greeting cards or flowers, or the much harder realities of dealing with interpersonal relationships that are trying or difficult. Even Anne Marie Jarvis, the woman who created the holiday in honor of her mother 101 years ago, wasn't happy with the way it turned out. Barely a decade later, the holiday was already commercialized, kind of like the Martin Luther King Day automobile sales today. And by 1943, she and her sister sought to rescind it. For better or for worse, they didn't succeed. That range of feelings was expressed by several mothers and daughters and a few men I spoke with in the Twin Ports this week, who shared their thoughts on the Mother's Day they most remember.
I'm Chrissy Patterson. I am a mother. I have two girls. Probably they were, I'm trying to think of the ages again. Bailey was walking, so she was probably 3 or 4, and then Danny would have been 6. So my husband at the time asked them to put together a fashion show for mom. And so what they did is they kind of just took their fanciest clothes that they had, and they did this really fun fashion show. And down in our basement, we had this stairwell landing, and they walked out on there, and they did the hip throw and the hair throw, and they walk back and forth, but at each time that they were just like, love you mom, happy Mother's Day, and it was super cute because they were so little when they did.
My name is Kaylin Zimmer. I feel like I never really did anything super special for my mom, which now that I'm a mom, I wish I would have like taken more opportunity. Actually, we always go fishing for Mother's Day. That's what we always do because my family goes fishing in Minnesota up in the Boundary Waters. It's not really for my mom that we did though, it's because my dad loves to go fishing and my mom loves my dad, so she goes fishing. So we also, as kids, would go fishing.
My name is Terry Botio. I'm from Ghana in West Africa. And my most memorable Mother's Day, we have it on a different day. The most memorable was when my sister came. My sister lives in Canada, and she came back home also. And she had just had her son, so she was a new mother also. And we all gathered. I come from a big family, so we're 6 kids, and my mom and my dad, and I mean, it was just so nice having everyone together because normally during the year, everyone is separated in different countries. And yeah, it was just fun to have everyone around. And my mom was so happy to see her daughter's daughter. She was now a grandmother on Mother's Day, and it was just perfect.
I'm Leslie Heitala from Artistic Florals by Leslie at 1705 Tower, Superior, Wisconsin. I've been in the shop for about 2.5 years, so it was my first Mother's Day here to actually do what I've always wanted to do. I've been a florist since 1972, but I've always worked for other florists. And so having my own flower shop on Mother's Day, that was probably the most memorable Mother's Day after having my child.
My name's Annie Dugan. I don't believe in Mother's Day. I think it's a cheap way to sell greeting cards. So the way I love spending Mother's Day is actually in the garden. So any Mother's Day that I can plant things or weed things, pull things out and kill things, is a great day for me.
My most memorable Mother's Day was, I want to say I was probably about 8 or 9 at the time, because I saw my little, like, we had my little sister who was still probably 1 or 2, and it was just going out to the garage at the time with a potted bleeding heart plant, and then cards that we had made for my mom, and like having my mom come out and like opening those up, and then also doing like crafts in the garage.
And your name is?
T. Leaper.
I'm Emily Darker. I'm from Superior Save the Kids, working with letters to prisoners. And I'm reading a letter from Winona, who's from Duluth and is incarcerated in Bayfield, Wisconsin, to her friend Lucas. I'm a 28-year-old, soon-to-be 29-year-old woman. My golden birthday is about a month, and it's super exciting. I live in Duluth, but I got caught up in Ashland almost 2 years ago. I did improve my life after by going to treatment, in and outpatient. I started working and decided to execute my time, which is a whopping 24 days. I have 10 more days left. And if you want to write back and forth, I fully support it and would love to. I have one small child. She's going on to 3 years old. Her name is Cortona. She's my life when I'm out and about. I'm currently married, brand new, April 20th at 4:30 p.m. this year. My son's name is Lucas, too. I hope you continue writing me. It's very lonely in here and really hard. I was on a PO hold, and now I'm just waiting around. I live in West Duluth and plan on going to work and hopefully keeping in contact. If you want, I can send a picture of my family. I read a lot, and I love to go out and about. My daughter is grown. I plan on going back to college, too, but just to finish my degree. She was a surprise. I'll be released on the 9th of September, but until then, you better write me, and hopefully when I get home, I'd like to know more about you. I love scary movies. I'm a great cook, and I love to write. I love music and being around others. Sincerely, Winona.
My name is Terry Kiddo. A few years ago, before Mother's Day, my mom was working on knitting a sweater, and she needed some more yarn to finish it. And I went looking through the stores where she got it from in the first place and couldn't find it. Looked all over the place, couldn't find it. Eventually found the number for the corporate number for the company that made the yarn, called it, and they said, oh, yeah, we have some of it in stock. Oh, but it's in Canada. Okay, can you ship it to me? For some reason, no, we cannot. So I'd gotten that close. They had the yarn in stores in Canada, and I didn't want to give up, so I reached out to some friends in a Facebook group, and a woman from Canada volunteered to go and look at her store and see if they had the yarn, and sure enough, they did in the color she needed, in the amount that she needed. So she volunteered to ship it to us, and it came about a week after Mother's Day, so it wasn't quite in time for the holiday, but Mom is still pretty happy to get it. That said, it's been 3 years now, and she still has not quite finished the sweater. So
it was the Mother's Day that we bought my mom a new couch set. And we had to be sneaky and get the old couch set out and get the new couch set in to give her a surprise.
She wasn't on the old couch at the time, was
she?
No,
she was not.
And your name is?
Gloria Esslinger.
Okay, well, my name is Jean Johnson McKeever. One of the most fun Mother's Days that I've had was the year that my two daughters and my granddaughter, we all went to the junk hunt, which was a big deal. And after that, we decided to go spend some time on Park Point a little bit. And then we ended up on, the old Lakeview Castle. And it happened to be the same weekend as the Derby, where they have all those real decorated hats. And they have a contest every year. So I said, can I, try them on? So I do have it on my Facebook page, Me and the Big Hat. And so I tried on several of them as we were sitting there. And I had a grandson that was working in North Dakota at the oil fields. And all of a sudden he shows up with a geranium, gives me a geranium, and he has to drive a long ways yet, but he drove all that way, his name is William, all the way up the shore before he had to head back to North Dakota to give me the geranium, and it touches your heart.
I'm Ellie Martin. I have three adult children, and last Mother's Day, my oldest was in Minneapolis and said she couldn't make it up to Duluth. My son was in Oakland, California, and my youngest daughter was in New Orleans. So I was feeling pretty forlorn, thinking I was going to spend Mother's Day all by myself, and was thinking, why did I have these kids anyway? But my oldest daughter called me from Minneapolis and said, are you going to be home? Because I'm going to have my friend drop off something for you for Mother's Day. And then within the hour, I hear someone on the front porch, and there's my daughter, big smile on her face, with a picnic basket that she had picked up at an estate sale that was complete with red checkered tablecloth and napkins and the whole works. And she had filled it with all my favorite things, Lay's potato chips, top of the tater, raspberry pie from the Rustic Inn. It was just delightful. And we packed up the car and went to Brighton Beach, spread our tablecloth on a flat rock and weighed down the ends so we didn't fly all over, although there was a very comical picture of me with the tablecloth completely covering my head. We took my dog Lucy with us, my little Yorkie poo. Then we went up the shore, one of my very favorite things to do. And we stopped at Castle Danger and sat out on their patio. But it was just the most delightful afternoon and such a good memory, especially because the following month I lost my little dog and she'd been with me for 16 years. So it's just a very special, precious Mother's Day to me.
My name is Brunette Yvonne Moore Cook, and my most memorable Mother's Day is every day that I was blessed to have children. In my family, I felt that we love each other, one another, just because, every day. And every day I'm alive with them is a special Mother's Day to me.
Dear Mother, I'm sending to you. This is Hear Me Out.
Best wishes and all the day through. May your days be cloudless and clear, bringing to you true happiness each day and night of the year. She's my mother.
Welcome back to Hear Me Out. I'm Robin Washington, and joining me in the studio is Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
Who is here to give us news from the last week, news from our area, or maybe news from the whole world, how it applies to our area.
That's right, Robin. A United Nations report released Monday says around 1 million animal and plant species are at risk of becoming extinct within decades. Stan Temple is a professor emeritus of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. Temple says Wisconsin is unique because it's close to the edges of major ecosystems.
And what that means for the state of Wisconsin is, especially in light of climate change, is that these ecosystems are going to be shifting. And as they shift, species that we think of as being part of the Wisconsin flora and fauna are going to leave the state and no longer be present.
Temple says northern Wisconsin is expected to see some of the most dramatic impacts. The UN report finds that the average abundance of native species on most major land habitats has fallen by about 20% since 1900. More than 200 plant and animal species are considered threatened or endangered in the state.
Did he give any particular examples that I might watch out for and be careful?
Possible shifts, yes. He said that potentially rough grouse, which is very common here in northern Wisconsin, may shift out of the state because of the changing climate, because it thrives in our colder temperatures.
It's not cold enough for them here?
I guess not. Well, if it gets warmer, if we start seeing these warmer temperatures shift northward, then maybe species like bobwhite quail, which haven't been as common in Wisconsin, might shift northward. So,
all right. I'll try to keep things cold for them.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is predicting record high water levels on some areas of the Great Lakes over the next 6 months. Melting snow and recent heavy rains have caused the lakes to rise rapidly over the last several weeks. That's according to Keith Kompoltowicz, Chief of Watershed Hydrology for the Army Corps. He says Lake Erie and Lake Superior are likely to see record high water levels over the next several months.
Looks like Lake Superior will tie its May record and break its June and July records before, again, tying again in August. So very high, record high levels on Lake Superior.
The record high for Lake Superior in May was set back in 1986 when it hit 602.82 feet above sea level. Kompoltowicz says they expect the lake to surpass its record for July, set back in 1950. He says communities along the shoreline will continue to face the threat of coastal flooding and erosion. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced Tuesday that it will contribute roughly $14 million to clean up a contaminated bay on Lake Superior. The federal government is funding roughly two-thirds of the $18.5 million cleanup of Howard's Bay in Superior. The project is part of efforts to remove the St. Louis River that runs between Duluth and Superior as a contaminated hotspot. The river is one of 43 sites that were designated as the most polluted on the Great Lakes. The cleanup project will remove sediments contaminated with metals like lead and mercury. Around 87,000 cubic yards of dredged material that meets environmental standards will be placed at a city landfill. In March, the Superior City Council approved around $2.5 million of in-kind contributions toward the project. The cleanup is expected to begin next year. The Public Service Commission and Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources are reviewing the environmental impacts of the proposed $700 million Nemadji Trail Energy Center in Superior. La Crosse-based Dairyland Power Cooperative and Minnesota Power submitted an application to the commission earlier this year on its plans to build the natural gas power plant. The facility is expected to provide as much as 625 megawatts of power when the utility providers are unable to draw from renewable sources like wind and solar. If built, the natural gas plant would create 260 construction jobs and about 25 full-time positions. It is also expected to generate roughly $1 million each year in local tax revenues. People are encouraged to submit any comments or concerns on its environmental impacts to the state by May 31st. More information is available online at psc.wi.gov. And a company owned by Xcel Energy has applied with the State Public Service Commission to build a new transmission line on the tip of northern Wisconsin. The utility company says the project is necessary to strengthen power in the area. Currently, one transmission line provides power to the Bayfield Peninsula, but it's aging and parts of the line are more than 50 years old. Ellen Heine is the permitting lead for the new line. She says the project provides a second source of power to the east side of the peninsula for cities like Washburn and Bayfield.
And that helps address reliability concerns that are more related to outage problems as well as voltage issues with low voltage that occurs.
Heine says two routes have been proposed. The transmission line would cost either $28 or $35 million, depending on the route. Kim Breaux is chair of the Washburn Town Plan Commission. Breaux says the Bayfield County Board has come out in favor of the route that follows the existing line.
It makes a lot more sense to concentrate the impacts in one right-of-way rather than building a whole new right of way to add energy going from Ashland up to Bayfield.
Heine with XL says both routes have pros and cons given cost, terrain, and environmental impacts. A paper mill in northern Wisconsin has announced it's seeking an alternative to bankruptcy in the face of declining demand and increasing pulp prices. Flambeau River Papers in Park Falls says a trustee will be appointed through the courts to oversee its operations amid financial struggles. The paper mill has operated under several different owners since it opened in 1896, according to Bill Johnson. He's director of government affairs for Flambeau River Papers. Johnson says the mill is looking for a buyer and scaling back operations.
Our goal is to work through this, play the market conditions that come to us. But right now our plan is to eventually have a layoff and move the mill to a one-machine mill.
Johnson says they may lay off employees in the next 60 days unless market conditions change. The mill employs around 200 workers. Park Falls Mayor Michael Boblick says the mill has been the center of economic activity for more than a century.
2 years ago, they were at 300, and now they're going to be at less than 200. So this really does have a significant impact to the community, from everything from housing, just discretionary income that's in the community, and definitely on morale.
Boblick says the city is open to discussing options with the mill to help maintain jobs there. U.S. Representative Sean Duffy has announced that he and his wife are expecting their ninth child. In a post late Monday on his official U.S. House website, Duffy wrote, quote, "God isn't done with our family yet. Baby number nine coming to the crew this fall." He wrote that he and his wife aren't crazy, just full of hope for America's future. Duffy is a Republican who has represented the 7th District in northwestern and central Wisconsin since 2011. It's the largest district in the state and covers all or part of 20 counties. He has been one of President Donald Trump's biggest backers in the state. Duffy and his wife, Rachel Campos Duffy, were both reality TV personalities and met through the MTV show The Real World.
All right, so this is actually reality, right? This is not in the script for a reality TV show.
Yeah,
right?
This is true to life.
Okay, they're going to find out when they get the bill for it. They'll know for sure. Give this to the producers. No, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
But, okay, so he wrote he's not crazy? Is that?
Yes, he's not crazy. That's what he said.
Okay, how old are they?
That's a good question. I don't know right off the bat.
Because God may not be done, but at a certain age, at least for Mrs. Duffy, right? You can't keep doing this forever.
Yeah.
Biological clock.
But that's
not
necessarily true. I mean, look at Jeff Goldblum. He had a child at age 66.
That's a male. Okay. I don't think I have to explain how these things work, do I?
Well, women
and
are
the Duffys know how it works very
days.
Well. I mean, and more power to them, and congratulations, I should say, too. But, you know, I do suspect there is a political motivation to this.
Oh, you think so?
Am I actually going here?
I don't think you're allowed to say that on public radio or just in general.
Or any radio or whatever.
Federal communications.
Because you noted about the county and, you know, how large it is or small, and it's the largest geographic district in the state, but not population-wise. But if the Duffys keep having children.
They're certainly going to grow the numbers of base.
Yep. Anyway, congratulations to the Duffys.
In other news, Wisconsin's tourism industry generated $21.6 billion last year. That's billion with a B. That's according to a new report from the State Department of Tourism. The report says visitor spending rose nearly 5% in 2018 to $13.3 billion. Tourism brought in $1.2 billion in federal taxes, $879 million in state taxes, and $703 million in local taxes. Most of the growth is tied to recreational activities. That seems like a given. A handful of counties saw visitor spending grow by about 10% or more, including Douglas and Bayfield counties. And a UW Superior student has been selected for an internship with the United Nations among hundreds who applied, according to a news release. UWS junior Angelica Ramash has already left to begin the seventh month. UWS junior Angelica Ramash has already left to begin the seven-month internship in the Office of the President of the United Nations General Assembly. The junior double majoring in economics and political science at UWS hails from Ecuador and has served as the country's youth ambassador at the Youth Assembly to the UN. As an intern, she will travel across the world to help carry out the UN's initiatives. She said in the release that her professors were very understanding and supportive, allowing her to finish up her classes when she returns this fall.
Well, that's an inspiring story. Thank you, Danny.
Yeah, you're welcome, Robin.
And speaking of inspiring stories, here's one that started out as part of our Mother's Day package, but turned out to be a story of Chicago gangsters in the Northland. Our colleague Norman Gilliland reports for Wisconsin Life.
Not long ago, by chance, I discovered the link between three things from my childhood: the Grand Canyon, Al Capone, and my mom. The last shall be first. My mother grew up in the 1920s on a small farm near Birchwood, Wisconsin, and during my youth in Florida, she occasionally told a story about the time some well-dressed men stopped by the house and asked for something to drink. Well, that sort of informality was not unusual in the North Woods at the time, and my grandmother obliged the visitors with homemade root beer. The men thanked her and continued on their way north. According to my mother, one of those men was Al Capone. I always took that story with a grain of salt. After all, the North Woods is a big place, and even in the 1920s and early 30s, there were a lot of people driving around up there. Who's to say that the man in the car was actually America's most notorious gangster? As the years pass, legends, family legends, can take on a reality of their own. I first heard the Capone story when I was in grade school. And back then, an ancient woman named Mrs. Hay came into our classroom once a week to teach us about music. The music she played for us on a portable turntable included that mainstay of Americana, Ferdy Groffé's Grand Canyon Suite. For us kids, the neat thing about the Grand Canyon Suite was that we could visualize what the music was describing. For example, a mule plodding down the canyon and letting out a big hee-haw at the end of the trip. Groffé was a masterful composer. He wrote the orchestration for George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, and his style comes through loud and clear in it. But it turns out that he also had a great imagination. I was in Lodi recently, watching a storm roll across Lake Wisconsin, and I thought I remembered something about Groffé getting his inspiration for the cloudburst that ends the Grand Canyon Suite from a storm on a lake someplace in Wisconsin. I did a little investigating, and suddenly a family legend came to life. It turns out that the debut of the Grand Canyon Suite was scheduled for November 22, 1931, at the Studebaker Theater in Chicago. With just 2 weeks to go, Groffé knew that he wanted to end the suite with a cloudburst, but he had no idea how to write it. To help him through his writer's block, a musician friend invited him up for a stay at Lake Chippewa in Wisconsin's North Woods. By the way, he said, when you come to a fork, the last fork you come to, be sure to take the right-hand turn, because if you take the left-hand turn, you'll go right into Al Capone's camp. Capone's so-called camp consisted of a stone house with 18-inch thick walls, a guard tower, and 407 wooded acres that sold for $2.6 million when Chippewa Valley Bank foreclosed on it in 2009. And that hideaway is only about 40 miles from Birchwood on what were mostly gravel roads in the 20s. So it's quite possible that my mother's story is true, that on some hot, dusty afternoon, Scarface and a few of his cronies did indeed pay my mother and her family a visit on their way to a place where they could relax and plan their next crimes. And who knows, maybe at the same time, Ferdy Groffé was watching a storm sweep across Lake Chippewa and getting his inspiration for that cloudburst that ends the Grand Canyon Suite.
If Norman had trouble believing his mother, fear not. Mine said the same thing when I was growing up in Chicago. She grew up in the area right by the St. Valentine's Day Massacre and told of finding bullet casings in the old warehouse. Between Norman's mother and mine, they must be right. That's it for this edition of Hear Me Out. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with the music of Boys to Men, A Song for Mama.
Anything, and no one else can do what you've done for me. You'll always be.